Welcome to another deep dive. This time, we're going to crack open Genesis chapters 5 through 11. We're going to explore some really fascinating narratives and interpretations from these ancient genealogies, and of course, the epic flood story to the Tower of Babel and its connection to real-life ziggurats.
It's incredible to think that these chapters lay the groundwork for so much of what comes later in the Bible.
Yeah.
Setting the stage for the arrival of Abraham and the covenant that really shapes biblical history.
It's like we're tracing the origins of humanity.
Right.
Both its, you know, triumphs and its downfalls.
Right.
So let's just start with the genealogies.
Okay.
I know family trees can sound a little dry, but trust me, these aren't just lists of names.
Right.
They offer some pretty profound insights. Take Genesis 5, for example.
Yeah.
It meticulously traces the lineage from Adam to Noah, highlighting each individual's lifespan.
Right.
And those lifespans are incredible.
They are.
These early patriarchs lived for centuries. Some over 900 years.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. It makes you wonder what was life like back then.
Well, one theory is that it reflects the gradual impact of sin on the human body over time.
Okay.
As sin entered the world, so did disease, genetic mutations, and all the things that eventually lead to mortality.
So it's like a slow decline from that original state of perfection.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's where it gets really interesting to me, if you think about it. The idea of being written in the book of life, which appears later in scripture, takes on a whole new meaning when we consider these early genealogies.
Exactly. Genealogies, in a sense, are a physical record of lineage.
Mm-hmm.
But the book of life speaks to a spiritual lineage.
Right.
One that transcends physical death. And it raises the question, what kind of legacy are we building? How will our choices impact our spiritual lineage?
Wow, that's deep.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to those shrinking lifespans.
Yeah.
By the time we get to Genesis 11, they're much shorter, more like what we're used to today. It's almost a visible reminder of humanity's growing distance from that original state of perfection.
And this decline seems to coincide with a rise in wickedness, as we see with the introduction of those mysterious beings you mentioned earlier, the Nephilim.
Right. Genesis 6:1-4, the whole sons of God taking the daughters of men as wives, which results in the birth of the Nephilim.
Right.
So walk me through these different interpretations of who the sons of God might be. Which one seems the most plausible to you and why?
Well, you got three main interpretations. The first suggests they were the descendants of Seth, Adam and Eve's third son, intermarrying with the descendants of Cain.
Okay.
The second, and perhaps the most unsettling, identifies them as fallen angels.
Fallen angels marrying human women.
Yeah.
That's a pretty wild concept.
It is a wild concept.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supported by references in other parts of the Bible, like Job and 2 Peter,
okay,
which describe angels being held in judgment for their actions. It paints a rather dark picture of the state of the world at that time.
Okay. I can see where you're coming from. But what about the Nephilim themselves? What were they like?
The term Nephilim is thought to be connected to the Hebrew word for fall.
Okay.
Which leads to debate over whether they were morally fallen, physically gigantic, or both.
Well, we do know from Numbers 13 that their descendants, the Anakim, were described as giants.
Right.
Making the Israelites feel like grasshoppers in comparison.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something to that whole giant interpretation.
Yeah, for sure.
But regardless of their exact nature, their presence seems to be connected to the escalating wickedness and violence that ultimately leads God to bring the flood right.
Exactly. And it's interesting to note that the same Hebrew word for corrupt is used to describe both humanity's actions and God's decision to flood the earth.
Mm.
It's like a cosmic measure-for-measure consequence.
So the world is in chaos, wickedness is rampant, and God decides to hit the reset button with a flood. Enter Noah, the righteous man. He's instructed to build an ark, or as it's called in Hebrew, a teva,
right,
representing this container of safety and hope amidst the coming destruction to preserve life.
Right.
But why seven of each clean animal? Why not just two like the other animals?
That's a detail that has puzzled scholars for centuries. One compelling theory suggests those extra animals were meant for sacrifice.
Right.
Remember, even before the flood, Cain and Abel understood the concept of animal sacrifice.
Right. And after the flood subsides, Noah's first act is to build an altar and offer sacrifices.
Exactly.
It's like God was saying, okay, we're starting over, but let's not forget the importance of acknowledging me, of expressing gratitude and seeking my blessing.
Exactly. And the fact that God specifies clean animals suggests a deliberate choice, a distinction between animals suitable for sacrifice and those that are not.
You might be wondering, how did Noah even know which animals were considered clean?
That's a great question.
Did God give him a list?
It's possible God gave him specific instructions, just as he provided detailed plans for the ark.
Right.
Or maybe the concept of clean and unclean animals was already part of an oral tradition passed down from Adam and Eve.
It's like trying to piece together a lost civilization based on these fragments and whispers from the past.
It is.
Fascinating. But then there's the flood itself.
Yeah.
Which raises a big question. What was its geographical extent?
Right.
The text describes it covering all the high mountains under the entire heavens.
Right.
But some scholars suggest it might have been more localized.
That's a debate that continues to this day. And it's interesting to consider the various perspectives. What's undeniable is that the flood represents a dramatic intervention, a cleansing of a corrupted world.
But here's another puzzle. If the flood wiped out all life except for those on the ark, how do we explain the presence of the Nephilim's descendants in Canaan afterward? It's like they survived the cataclysm.
It is a mystery. One possibility is that the memory of the Nephilim lived on even if they themselves perished. Their reputation for power and violence might have been passed down through generations, shaping the procession of their descendants.
Or could it be that some actually did survive?
It's possible.
We know they were described as heroes of old men of renown.
Right.
Maybe they possessed abilities or resources that allowed them to weather the storm, so to speak. That's an intriguing possibility. And it highlights that even in the face of divine judgment, the consequences of past actions can linger, shaping the future in unexpected ways. But even with those lingering echoes of a corrupted past, we see a new beginning emerge. Immediately after the flood subsides, Noah builds an altar and offers sacrifices to God, a powerful testament to his unwavering faith.
And this event is significant for another reason, right? It marks the first use of the Hebrew word berit, meaning covenant.
Exactly.
It signifies a deepening of the relationship between God and humanity.
Yes.
A promise of ongoing protection and blessing.
It does feel like a fresh start, a new chapter in the story of humanity's relationship with God.
It truly feels like a fresh start.
It does.
A new chapter in the story of humanity's relationship with God.
And that fresh start is echoed in another flood narrative.
Go bay.
This one found in the Epic of Gilgamesh, specifically the tale of Utnapishtim, who is essentially the Mesopotamian version of Noah.
Right. Two flood stories, both involving a chosen survivor and a vessel packed with animals. But there are some pretty significant differences, aren't there?
Absolutely. In the Gilgamesh epic, Utnapishtim is instructed to build a cube-shaped ark.
A cube. That doesn't seem very seaworthy.
Exactly. From a practical standpoint, it wouldn't be very effective at all.
Right.
And while Noah is explicitly commanded by God to preserve creation,
right,
Utnapishtim seems more concerned with personal wealth, bringing silver and gold aboard his ark.
Interesting. It's like two very different motivations. Preservation out of obedience versus self-preservation driven by material possessions.
Right.
What else stands out to you?
The overall tone of the stories.
Okay.
In Genesis, we see divine intervention, a clear plan for salvation.
Mm.
In Gilgamesh, there's this element of trickery and manipulation with Utnapishtim, using deception to survive.
Mm. It makes you wonder if the biblical account is presenting a critique of the more self-serving, less morally grounded version found in the Gilgamesh epic.
That's a very insightful observation. And it underscores the importance of looking beyond the surface similarities to understand the deeper theological and ethical messages embedded in these ancient narratives.
Okay, back to Genesis. We got the flood, the covenant, and then things take a rather strange turn with the incident involving Noah, his son Ham, and a curse placed on Canaan.
This is one of those passages that can leave you scratching your head, especially since it's rarely preached on.
Right. It's definitely a bit awkward.
Mm-hmm.
So Noah gets drunk, passes out naked in his tent, and Ham, upon seeing his father in this state, does something.
Yeah.
We're not exactly sure what.
Now, the phrase, seeing the nakedness of, is significant.
Okay.
It's used multiple times in the Bible, often in Leviticus.
Okay.
And it's connected to shame and, in some cases, prohibited sexual practices.
So Ham's transgression might have been more serious than simply seeing his father naked.
That's a possibility. Some scholars suggest that Ham may have committed some kind of sexual act against Noah.
Oh, wow.
Which would explain the severity of the curse placed on Canaan, Ham's son.
It's certainly a disturbing thought.
It is.
It makes you wonder about the true nature of Ham's transgression and why the consequences fell on his son instead of him directly.
It's a puzzle for sure.
Yeah.
But it reminds us that even in the aftermath of a catastrophic event like the flood, human nature, with all its complexities and flaws, remains a constant.
Speaking of human nature, let's move on to the Tower of Babel, a story that's all about pride, ambition, and the dangers of trying to reach for the divine without, well, actually involving the divine.
The Tower of Babel is a classic tale of hubris.
Yeah.
Humanity, united by a single language, decides to build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens to make a name for ourselves.
Right.
It's an attempt to achieve immortality and fame through their own efforts, driven by a fear of being scattered across the earth.
It's like they're saying, we can do this without God. We can reach heaven on our own terms.
And this desire to reach the heavens is directly tied to the historical context of ziggurats.
Right.
These massive step structures were common in ancient Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
And were believed to be the dwelling places of the gods.
So the Tower of Babel wasn't just a random tower. It was likely a ziggurat meant to rival the dwelling place of God. Talk about a power move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And God's response is fascinating. He doesn't destroy the tower in some fiery display of wrath. Instead, he scatters them across the earth and confuses their languages.
Again, with that measure-for-measure consequence. Well, they feared being scattered, so God scatters them.
Yeah.
They wanted to make a name for themselves, so God divides them through language,
right,
making it much harder to achieve unity and fame.
It's a brilliant and subtle form of judgment, one that acknowledges humanity's capacity for both greatness and folly.
And in a way, it sets the stage for the next major figure in the biblical narrative, Abraham.
Yes. The genealogy in Genesis 11 introduces us to Terah, the father of Abram, who will later become Abraham.
Right.
And significantly, the text highlights Terah's lineage from Shem, one of Noah's sons.
So we're tracing a direct line from the survivors of the flood to the man who will become the father of many nations, a pivotal figure in God's plan for humanity.
It's an incredible story of God's faithfulness and his enduring love for his creation.
And that's where we'll pick up next time on our deep dive into Genesis.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's incredible to think that from this point forward, the story of the Bible becomes increasingly focused on this one family line leading all the way to Jesus.
It really is. And it highlights the power of individual choices and the ripple effects they can have across generations. Abraham's decision to follow God's call set in motion a chain of events that would ultimately change the course of human history.
And speaking of Abraham, before we dive into his story, I wanted to circle back to a detail from the flood narrative that I found particularly interesting. Why were there 7 pairs of clean animals? Why not just 2 like the other animals? It's almost like those extra clean animals were there for a specific reason.
Right. Well, that's a detail that has puzzled scholars for centuries. But the theory that those extra animals were meant for sacrifice is a compelling one. You have to remember that Noah immediately builds an altar and offers sacrifices after the flood subsides.
So it's like a continuation of what we see with Cain and Abel, that understanding that acknowledging God through sacrifice is crucial.
Exactly. And the fact that God specifies clean animals suggests a deliberate choice, a distinction between animals suitable for sacrifice and those that are not.
Which begs the question, how did Noah know which animals were considered clean? Did God give him a detailed list, or was it something passed down through generations?
Those are great questions. It's possible that God gave Noah specific instructions, just as he provided detailed plans for the ark. Or it could be that the concept of clean and unclean animals was already part of an oral tradition passed down from Adam and Eve.
It's like we're catching these glimpses into a lost world, trying to piece together their customs and knowledge based on these fragments. Okay, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about something that I think often gets glossed over in Sunday school, but is actually really fascinating. The incident with Ham. You know, the story with Noah, his son Ham, and the curse placed on Canaan.
Yes. It's definitely a passage that can be easily misunderstood. We need to approach it with sensitivity and a careful understanding of the historical context.
Yeah, I've heard some people use it as a way to justify slavery or racism, but that seems like a huge stretch to me.
Absolutely. It's crucial to remember that interpreting this passage as condoning slavery or racism completely misses the point.
So help me understand, what is the point of this story? What is it trying to tell us?
Well, the text itself is a little ambiguous. We know that Noah gets drunk, passes out naked in his tent. Then Ham does something after seeing his father in this state, and it earns him a curse. The problem is that the exact nature of Ham's transgression is never explicitly stated.
Right. It just says that Ham saw his father's nakedness and told his brothers about it.
And that phrase, seeing the nakedness of, is really important here. It's used many times throughout the Bible, particularly in Leviticus, and it's almost always connected to prohibited sexual practices.
So are you saying there's a possibility that Ham did something more than just look at his father?
It's definitely something that scholars consider. Some believe that Ham may have committed a sexual act against Noah, and that would help to explain the severity of the curse.
Okay, that's definitely a disturbing thought. But if that's the case, why is the curse directed at Cain and Ham's son rather than Ham himself? It seems a little unfair, doesn't it?
It adds another layer of complexity to the story, for sure. One possibility is that the curse is less about a specific individual and more about the consequences of a transgression rippling through generations. The idea that actions have consequences not just for ourselves, but for our descendants as well.
Kind of like the sins of the father being visited upon the children.
You could say that. And it's worth noting that later in the Bible, the Canaanites are often described as a people who have polluted the land with their practices, which could be a reference back to this original transgression, but it's definitely not about justifying any sort of mistreatment.
It's more about understanding the historical and theological context of their portrayal in the Bible.
Exactly. It's a cautionary tale, a reminder that our actions have consequences both for ourselves and for those who come after us. Speaking of cautionary tales, I think we have to talk about one of the most well-known stories from this section of Genesis. The Tower of Babel.
It's one of those stories that transcends the Bible. It's been told and retold for centuries, and it's inspired so much art and literature. Why do you think this story continues to capture our imaginations?
I think it's those universal themes: pride, ambition, the desire for power and recognition, and even the fear of being scattered, of losing our identity. It's something that resonates with everyone, even today.
It feels like the ultimate story of human overreach. Trying to reach the divine through our own efforts without acknowledging God or seeking his guidance.
And that tower itself is so symbolic. It represents humanity's attempt to build something lasting, to make a name for themselves, to achieve immortality through their own achievements.
It's that classic human desire to leave our mark on the world, to be remembered long after we're gone.
But this story also warns us about the dangers of unchecked ambition, about letting our desires for power and recognition cloud our judgment.
And the way God responds is so interesting to me. He doesn't just obliterate the tower in a fit of rage. Instead, he confounds their language, creating a barrier to communication and effectively scattering them across the earth.
It's such a subtle but powerful form of judgment. They wanted to build a tower to reach heaven, but their pride and arrogance led to their downfall.
Pride goes before the fall.
Exactly. And the scattering of the people and the confusion of languages is significant. It marks a turning point in human history, a shift from a unified world to a world of diverse cultures and languages.
It's like the origin story for the world as we know it, a world of both unity and division, of cooperation and conflict. And it's in this context, this world of scattered people and diverse languages, that the story of Abraham begins.
It's like we're moving from the grand sweeping narrative of creation and the flood to the more intimate story of one man and his family, chosen by God to play a pivotal role in the unfolding drama of redemption.
It's like God is saying, okay, I've shown you what happens when humanity as a whole goes astray. Now let me show you what can happen when one person chooses to follow me, to trust in my promises.
And that's the beauty of the biblical narrative. It's a story that unfolds on multiple levels, weaving together the grand themes of creation, judgment, and redemption with the intimate details of individual lives, choices, and consequences.
It's like a tapestry with each thread contributing to the overall beauty and complexity of the design.
Okay, so let's talk about Abraham.
Abraham's story is a testament to faith and obedience, but it's also a story of human fallibility. He wasn't a perfect man, and the Bible doesn't shy away from his flaws and mistakes. He even pretended his wife was his sister twice to save his own skin. Not exactly a shining example of integrity, is it?
No, it's not. But those moments of human weakness actually make his story all the more relatable, don't you think? Even those chosen by God are not perfect. They make mistakes. They face challenges. They struggle with doubt.
You're right. It's like their humanity makes their faith even more inspiring. They weren't superhuman. They were just ordinary people who chose to trust in an extraordinary God.
And that's such a powerful message for us today. No matter our background, our flaws, or our past mistakes, God can use us for his purposes if we are willing to surrender to his will.
It really is amazing to think that this one man, Abraham, becomes such a pivotal figure in the grand narrative of the Bible. I mean, from his lineage comes Jesus. That's quite a legacy.
It's incredible, isn't it, when you think about it? It all goes back to those individual choices we were talking about. Abraham's decision to follow God's call sets off a chain of events that ripples through history, shaping the destiny of nations and ultimately leading to the fulfillment of God's promises.
Yeah, and it's not like he was perfect, right?
Yeah.
We just talked about how he lied about Sarah being his sister.
Right.
Not just once, but twice. Talk about a test of faith.
I know.
Makes you wonder how he could be considered righteous with those kinds of flaws.
Well, that's the thing about the Bible, right? It doesn't shy away from presenting its heroes as flawed human beings.
Right.
Abraham, despite his moments of weakness, had an unwavering faith in God.
Yeah.
He trusted God, even when things got tough, even when he didn't fully understand.
That's something I think we can all relate to, right? Those moments where we doubt, where we make mistakes, where we struggle to trust. It's comforting to know that even the father of faith had his share of struggles.
Exactly. And it's through those struggles that his faith shines even brighter. He could have easily given up, could have chosen to go back to his old life, but he kept going. He kept trusting.
Yeah, it's inspiring, really. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Genesis chapters 5 through 11, what are some of the key takeaways you hope listeners will remember?
Well, I think one of the biggest takeaways is the interconnectedness of everything. From those genealogies to the flood to the Tower of Babel, we see a pattern emerge. Individual choices have consequences that reach far beyond ourselves.
Right.
They impact families, communities, and even the course of history.
It's like we're all part of something bigger than ourselves.
Right.
Our actions matter no matter how small they may seem.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another important point is that God is intimately involved in human history.
Yeah.
He's not some distant, uninvolved deity. He's actively engaged, working to redeem and restore his creation.
It's a hopeful message, isn't it? Even when we see humanity at its worst, even when we see the consequences of sin and rebellion, we also see a God who never gives up on his people.
Yeah.
A God who's constantly working to bring good out of chaos.
Absolutely. And that brings us to the threshold of a new era, the era of Abraham and the covenant God makes with him.
Right.
A covenant that promises blessings, not just for Abraham and his descendants, but for all nations.
Yeah. It's a reminder that these stories aren't just ancient history. They're filled with timeless truths that speak to us today. They challenge us, they inspire us, and they point us towards a deeper understanding of ourselves, our world, and our place in God's grand story.
I think that's a great way to put it. As you continue exploring the Bible, remember that you're not just reading a collection of ancient texts.
Yeah.
You're engaging with a living narrative.
Right.
A story that continues to unfold in our own lives and in the world around us.
So as we conclude this deep dive into the fascinating and foundational chapters of Genesis, here's a final thought-provoking prompt for you. Could the Tower of Babel story be seen as a cautionary tale against the dangers of unchecked ambition and fear, even in our modern world?
It's definitely something to think about.
Yeah.
Those same desires for power, recognition, and security are still at play today. And the question remains, will we try to build our own towers, relying on our own efforts? Or would we trust in God's guidance and allow him to lead us towards something greater?
So much to ponder. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Genesis chapters 5 through 11. It's been an enlightening journey. Until next time.